This week on A to Z Running, we continue our series on change by examining mindset, the first section of Brad Stelberg's book.
Also, we answer a listener's question about when to lift weights.
In the world of running, world 800 meter champion Donovan Brazier is back in the news, and we'll share why.
Dubai Marathon was fast and surprising in both the men's and women's races.
And Outside Magazine has some success tips for winter training based on Strava data.
All this and more on A to Z Running.
Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I'm Zach, and you can learn more about our services and support for runners at atozrunning.com and check us out on the places where we do the things. We're on YouTube, Instagram, and Spotify. And if you didn't know, Spotify is like just constantly adding all of these features to the things that they do. And you can now watch on Spotify. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They have video option now, and we do post video. So for those of you who have been listening and you thought, well, that's just enough of Zach and Andy. I don't need to actually see Zach's ugly mug as well. Although you may want to watch so you can see Andy because, you know, it's worth it. But
so awkward.
You can also ask questions right on Spotify. There's an interact feature built into podcasts there. It's kind of nifty. And then we get your questions there. So when we do our questions segment, it's just one more easy way to ask questions. Mm. And we know that a fair number of you do, in fact, listen on Spotify because, you know, they tell us these kinds of things. And as it were, you could be interacting even more and you would get more out of it.
And we have caught up on our YouTube channel. We, for a little bit, did not have every podcast episode, but we caught up on that. So I apologize to you YouTube listeners, but it's back up.
And those of you who do watch on YouTube and have subscribed and received notifications, I'm fascinated to know what those notifications were like in the last couple of weeks while we were
ding, catching things up.
Why are they posting so much so suddenly? Yeah, well, that's just kind of what happened. But now you can find everything you need in all the places. Just look for A to Z Running.
Yeah. And if you need a race in the West Michigan area coming up this spring, check out Rivertown Races. We are supporting it again this year through our training services. And what's new this year is that we have daily training emails so that you don't have to go looking for it, although we do have the plan posted as well. And a little bonus too, this is a rarity, but Zach also included some encouragement into those emails and information for those days. Information is not surprising, but the encouragement bit is.
I don't know what she's talking about. I'm plenty encouraging. But I have to apologize for those of you who are receiving the training daily emails and Zach's occasional quips that are not funny, but Zach thinks they're funny to him, even if to no one else. My sense of humor makes me laugh. But anyway.
I'm glad you amuse yourself.
It's amusing as well as encouraging and informative from time to time. Yeah, so the thing is, what we're doing with these training emails is we're saying, okay, chances are many of you would love to just get hit every morning with an email that says, here's what you should do today. And that's very convenient. Further still, though, because it's an email format, you can cram a whole bunch more content into one email that you don't have to see unless you want to. And if you keep scrolling down the email, you realize, oh, look, they've also included recommendations for strength and mobility with a video right there. They've included some additional resources to help me understand how to do the thing I'm supposed to be doing today if I need that. And it's jam-packed with good. And all you have to do is sign up for free because we're not charging anything for it.
So yeah, but you do have to be part of Rivertown Races.
Well, you got to be running Rivertown Races because that's what it's for.
Right, exactly.
Training for Rivertown. They have a 5K, 10K, and half marathon in the end of April. I believe the date is April 20.
There you go. Very good. So good. All right. Well, now let's get started with your questions. Remember, you can send your questions to atozrunning.com/questions, or you can email us at questions@atozrunning.com.
We love to hear from you. So be sure to send them, send as many of them as come to mind. There is no limit. So you can ask a question anytime you want. And with that, we've got a great one here from Amanda. Amanda writes, is it better to lift before an easy run or after? Any insight? I'm working on building more muscles as I get older. And my sister, a former athletic trainer, wrote me a lifting plan. Oh, that's great. Very helpful. I've been spacing it out so that I'm lifting about 2 days a week plus 1 day of core pelvic floor exercises, but I'm not sure if I should lift before my easy runs or after. I also make sure I lift on the 1 to 2 days per week that I don't run. So what about the others? Okay, so in summary, the question is when's the best time to lift as it pertains to other activity that she's doing?
Well, the answer would be it depends. I know that's what you knew that we were going to say. But you have to know what your priority is for the day. And where you're at in training is also going to determine how you want to do your lifts. Because if you're in building, then it doesn't matter so much because you can prioritize your lift if you're just doing easy jogging, you're doing easy running. But once you start incorporating workouts, things do become more complicated or if your loads do increase. So Zach had a few thoughts on this.
Yes. Well, so Amanda, as Andy noted, depending on where you're at in training, we would suggest one of a few scenarios here. So in any event with a question like this, further context that matters is where are you at with respect to like progress in a training season? Where are you at with respect to, are you like rehabilitating an injury or something like that? Or what does the overall training load look like? So in general, broadly speaking, there are reasons to lift before running and reasons to lift after running. So that's why we say it can depend quite a bit. Also, as a rule, we tend to prefer that lifting sessions happen at a different time than running sessions. So if you're going to run in the morning, lift in the afternoon. If you're going to run in the afternoon, lift in the morning. And only because you get greater adaptation from both when you space them out like that, depending on what you're doing. I mean, if you're running short and easy, then it probably doesn't matter at all. So then you could combine them. If you're running very long and easy or harder efforts, then we would separate those more. That said, there's also arguments to be made for the exact opposite. And so that's why I say, depending on the situation. For instance, if you're in the building stages, if you're in the early stages of training, then a priority is on training load, overall volume, at easy efforts. And in that sense, lifting is also strength building in general is very important during this period of time. And so we would say things like, you know, it's not a bad idea to do things like lift for an hour and then go run for an hour and a half. That's not a terrible thing to do in that scenario. One, because you're not really doing the same thing physiologically, lifting weights, as you are running really easy. And so as a consequence, you can gain those adaptations in combination with each other. But also in a similar sense, it helps when you're a little bit tired from lifting, it kind of slows you down a little bit on your running, which isn't a bad thing either. So we have some broad application things here. We like lifting to follow hard efforts. So if you're doing a hard effort day and you're lifting and running on the same day, we like the running to be first. If you're doing longer effort runs, we like the running to be first, with some few exceptions. And in general, your question, should we lift on easy days or harder days? Then in some sense, it tends to be preferable to lift on harder effort days because harder effort days are usually shorter runs. But again, that's in our program. That's not always the case in someone's training program. So the way we assign it, our harder effort runs are almost always shorter efforts during the week than easy effort runs. And so lifting makes more sense on harder effort days because otherwise you're spending 3 hours working out.
And also then you are able to have more time in between efforts that would, you know, cause micro tears, because both running hard and lifting cause micro tears. So it'd be great if you had a day of easy in between, you know, so if you do both things on a hard day, then you have more time to recover.
Yeah, the thinking is the easy day is a kind of recovery, and so do all the stuff that need more time to recover altogether. But again, that's going to depend on the context. So if we've got a runner who is well entrenched in a training program and things are going smoothly, that's likely to be the case. That's going to make sense. But if a runner is a little bit in a more fragile state or just really starting to build into some harder effort stuff and wants to add lifting at the same time, the recommendation changes. So this is why we say context really matters with something like this. Mm-hmm. You want to tax your system enough to adapt well, but not so much that it wears you down, so you need additional time to recover. So however you can do that in your current situation, add the lifting where it makes the most sense so that every day you're able to do the thing well that you're trying to do that day.
Now, the core and pelvic floor stuff can be done before or after, of course, but I would say that it might be beneficial to do it before because you're able to activate and engage the kinetic chain more properly after doing those things. So you might want to consider doing that pre-run.
Absolutely. It should be noted that most core workouts are not, they're not highly destructive in nature. You know, so you could say like hill repeat workouts are very taxing for the body. They break you down a fair bit. Core workouts don't tend to be the case, which is why they're also really valuable for activation and things like that. Because if you think about it, you're trying to, when you run, you want to be in an active state in your core. And if you've done a core workout and then, you know, you don't want to just run 10 seconds later. But if that was 15 minutes ago or 20 minutes ago, and then you're running, you're likely to be in a more active state.
Yeah. So a few things to recap, like that we recommend, and this isn't exactly answering Amanda's question, but it kind of ties into this conversation. We always recommend focusing on functional movements, the movements that you perform while running, like single leg stuff. Focus on high weight, low rep routines with plenty of rest in between, and never perform more than 2 lifting sessions in a week if you're in training, as we recommend training. So that's going to look different depending on what your program looks like and how much running you do. But if you're looking to be in a marathon training cycle, we would recommend 2 days a week.
Yeah. And if we can, just a brief note for you, Amanda, here on this functional lifting side of things. So you have a lifting program given to you, always noting that the idea here as a runner is that we want to make sure that we're strengthening things that perform the action that we're trying to perform. And so a good example of that, Andy said single leg stuff, but also the idea of you're never in a stable state when you're running. Like you're always slightly unbalanced because you're on 1 foot at a time, because you're in motion, you're not standing still. And so anytime you can do a lift that puts you into an unstable state and you have to stabilize while you're doing the lift, that can be very valuable. But it also means you're generally doing things with less weight. You're not doing a ton of weight in this kind of a sense, and you tend to be doing things, you can't do as many reps of something, you know, because you're falling over or something like that. So you can't be as fatigued while you're doing it. So that's where we say, okay, higher weight, lower rep, but it can't be so much weight that you can't manage the motion. And then that principle of destabilized while you're doing it, it's all good.
Cool. Well, thank you for your question, Amanda. Now let's get on to our main topic.
Last week, we kicked off our series, being that it is the beginning of a new year, and for many of us, we're changing something, or even if we're not, we're experiencing change, which is one of the principal points we're going to be making here this week. Change is happening, and how can we navigate it best? Which may be, in the way that I have said that, somewhat counterintuitive to the author, Brad Stolberg's comments, and I'll get to that here in a little bit. But as it were, we want to try to address, as runners, there's a lot to be said about how we interact with our expectations and our environment and the things that are happening in a micro sense in the midst of a run or a race or otherwise, and in a macro sense, in terms of just kind of like managing all of it to be able to thrive as runners.
It's interesting because recently, not in context of our discussions about this, I was thinking about the topic of expectations. And I think it does come to the forefront of our mind when we start thinking about goals and we are planning seasons and things. So I think this will be a great conversation for many of us as we look towards the future. And as runners, we're always trying to get better at our craft, to get better at our sport. And so I think that having proper expectations is such an important element of our mindset.
More on that soon. One disclaimer caveat. You know that Zach likes to wax philosophical. We're going to try to avoid as much of that as we can. On a topic like this, it's kind of existential in nature. You know, people start talking about change and they're talking about like really big ideas. And that is in fact the case in various senses of Brad Stolberg's work, which we're using as a frame of reference for the conversation here. But in principle, we're really trying to identify how, as runners, how we can apply this to our particular nuance. But at the same time, we have to say that we do not feel, Andy and I, that running is the be-all, end-all of anything. It's a lot of fun. We love to talk about it. You know that because you hear us do it a fair bit. And that may be the only thing you hear us talk about, in fact, or just about. However, it is a very, very, very small slice of what is important in life and the world. So small, in fact, that we're not going to try to measure it against the actual important things. But it's valuable to you, or you wouldn't be listening to us. It's valuable to us, and it matters in some sense. And so we look at things like this that have these kind of broad-ranging applications, and we can apply them to our very specific interest here. And we enjoy that, and that is good. But at the same time, don't hear us say that running is like something that should define who we are either, because it shouldn't. So with that, let's talk about... All right, I mentioned last week, we're reading Brad Stolberg's work, Master of Change. And this is his latest book published, came out in 2023. And you've heard us reference Stolberg and Steve Magnus. They host a lot of stuff together, have published books together and such. We reference their work a fair bit. It's important to note that just because we reference their work a fair bit does not mean we agree with everything that they conclude in all of their works, but we find it valuable. And so what Stolberg did in this particular work is he took the concept of change and he said, okay, what is the base principle that should define the idea of change and our response to it? So he created two base principles. We mentioned these in passing last week and intentionally not getting too far into it because we knew we would in the coming weeks here. And then with those two considerations, then he said, okay, what are the key aspects of this, and broke it down into three parts. And we're going to tackle each one of those three parts in the next 3 weeks. So you have a nice sense of these facets of change. Okay, first, just a quick note. This term that I just find so interesting that Stolberg mentions, he did not coin this term. It's been around. But they keep saying we need to use a different frame of change. Instead of homeostasis as like what is normal, we should be using this concept called allostasis, which is allo is apparently Greek that has something to do with like variety, and stasis means like standing. So it basically means like you're in a kind of sense of change all the time. So if homeostasis is like things are the same, they're like, well, but things aren't the same, and which is true. Things aren't. And so
that's valid.
We shouldn't use homeostasis as the like anchor point. We should use something else. So that's the baseline principle number one. Baseline principle number two then is, in Stolberg's words, our response to this concept of allostasis is then what he calls rugged flexibility. I mentioned that last week. Rugged flexibility in reference to tough and durable, that's the rugged side of it, and then this adapt and bend without breaking sense on the flexibility side of it. And remember my caveat, anytime we talk about things like bending without breaking, that's the reed blowing in the wind, right? It's good to be the reed bending in the wind. It's bad to be the plant that is constantly being uprooted and transplanted somewhere else over and over and over. So keep in mind, there's some kind of difference there, and we'll continue to come back to that. And then just to quote Stolberg directly, the goal of rugged flexibility, he writes, is to get to a favorable reorder, to maintain a strong core identity, but at the same time to adapt, evolve, and grow. So that's what we say, that strong core identity piece. So in that sense, change is not an acute event that happens to you. Again, Stolberg's words. But rather, it is a cycle of order, disorder, reorder that is a constant of life. So there's always some kind of disordering of things that eventually creates some kind of new allostasis, normal, that will inevitably disorder again. Okay, got all that stuff out of the way. Now, we're not going through like every single, here's everything they have to say about this, but we wanted to draw from you, from this work for you, what are some really interesting connections between this principle and what we do when we are trying to achieve things, make progress, achieve goals, make a change in our lives, as many of us are doing right now. Remember, we mentioned the study. Apparently, a lot of people have fitness goals this year, if not, you know, all the time.
80% of the goals were fitness goals?
No, like that? It was like 50%.
Okay.
But like 30% more of them were like health related. Okay. And so it's kind of the same thing. So, yes. Now, that's being the case, Stolberg says the first thing we should look at with this idea is our mindset, which I think is a valuable way to start anything. And in particular, the side of this that we're looking at here is how we perceive the changes, which is really interesting. So, couple key takeaways and what this may or may not have to do with us as we're trying to achieve, progress, or make change. First of all, in several different ways, he actually writes about a number of different psychological principles that connect to this point. Change happens, well established so far on this episode, and it's often bad. Those are my words, not Stolberg's.
Well, I think interesting.
Go ahead.
Because I think that is also a perception thing. Because if you are just really loving homeostasis, it would seem bad because it's a disruption. But I would not say all change, like that it's mostly bad, that most change is bad.
Except the point he comes back to over and over, which is just funny to me because I'm a pessimist.
He is.
So it's funny to me that this is the way. So the point is, you're right. There's an expectation element. We'll come to that. Actually, it's the most important, in fact, piece of this puzzle as we're going to talk about it here. But objectively, pain or change often includes pain, suffering, and hardship.
Oh, I thought you were I didn't realize you were going to say pain next. I thought you were like doing a Freudian slip where you said pain instead of change. Okay.
No. Change often includes pain, suffering.
Yeah, I'm not laughing at the pain and suffering folks.
Yeah, right. No.
Yeah,
but the point is, so as Andy's already applying an optimistic sense to something, which she will do, and Zach will then do the exact opposite, I was just like resonating with this constant. He's got so many different ways to essentially say we will suffer. At some point, in some sense, we will suffer. We know this to be true in life, in running, in everything, right? But there are some key considerations around that. So on the note of suffering in general, Daniel Gilbert is some kind of psychologist and has this term that he calls inescapability trigger. I'm not sure what the trigger part essentially is about, except that the point is there is something that improves in an individual's general sense of the world when that person decides that some change is here to stay and there's nothing I can do about that. So this idea of like, I can't stop this inevitable thing. It's happening. That's the way it's going to be. And I have to get past that.
What do you say? That's like moving from denial to acceptance.
Well, sure. That's exactly what it's like. I would also say that it's context dependent, as always, because at the same time, it's very easy for this to turn into a kind of prolonged despair, which is there are things we don't control. And that's the point that Gilbert makes in this work. There are things we don't control. And when we try to exert expectation that's unreasonable or control over the uncontrollable things, then it just produces undesirable results all the time. And so this is where we have to apply, okay, in goal setting in general, you know this, in goal setting in general, we have to address the thing we control, not the other factors that we would like to be the case that may or may not be things we can do anything about. And so I want to make a change in something. I identify what about the thing I can influence, and that's where I focus my efforts and attention. And the things that I can't influence, whatever they may be, this is where Gilbert says we need to have this sense of, he actually specifically writes the word resignation. So we have to quit fighting against the thing that we cannot influence. And when we do, we end up having more energy to figure out how to cope with it. So even if it's a negative thing, we can better deal with it when we stop fighting against it and start figuring out how to live with that, whatever that may be. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think it is. And do you have any examples of this? Did he give any examples?
Yes. He gave like this constant example throughout the whole thing that it was just, he had two of them and he just kept going back to them. The one was this professional rock climber who accidentally sawed off his finger.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this rock climber, I can't remember his name, was top of the game, sawed off his index finger on his dominant hand. And if you know anything about rock climbing, that's a very important finger. I don't know anything about rock climbing, so I'm only saying this because he said it in the book that it's important. So that is then this like analogy he uses throughout. And he says in this particular instance, that rock climber has to come to this realization that I cannot do this the same that I've done in the past. It's not possible anymore because I have a missing finger. And so what it became then was knowing that that's true. Now what I'm going to do with my energy and effort is I'm going to figure out how to do this thing without the finger. You're rewriting the schema. So that's in that sense. There's a lot involved there. I think one of the key takeaways for runners with this concept is that one is when we experience a kind of injury, whatever the severity, we have to recognize the fact that if the injury is such, and in most cases it is, that we shouldn't be running, then we should stop trying to run until it's good to do so again. I cannot tell you how many times we talk to runners, and we have been in this situation ourselves, where we know that running is hurting us. It's making something worse or it's delaying its healing. And we keep doing it. How silly do you get? Like, I need to heal right now, but I'm not because I'm simply not letting myself do so. So this is part of that, like, I can't make myself get better by running. I need to realize that, resign myself to the fact, and then figure out how to cope. What am I going to do to get back to health? What am I going to do to delay the onset of whatever, you know, if I can do other activity or something? Second layer of that same concept, which we're not going to spend very much time on, but just to note here, is this term called tragic optimism. And I quote, define the term, Zach. Tragic optimism from page 57 in the book is the ability to maintain hope and find meaning in life despite its inescapable pain, loss, and suffering. So that is, in Jesus' words, in this life, you will have trouble. It's a guarantee, but If we know that to be true, I have yet to meet a human who has not experienced suffering. We can still find meaning and hope in the midst of that. And because we can, there's an optimism there or potential for it. But that's why it's tragic, because it's inevitable difficulty as well.
Yeah. And I've seen many people with beautiful, tragic optimism. And it's very encouraging. And I think that that is the power of story and knowing people and being able to hear the story of suffering and how there's parts of us that that grow and that we can still find joy. And for us, that's in God and our purposes as his created ones.
And there's a lot to be said further still on the topic of where we find identity, which happens to be the second of the main three parts that Stolberg addresses. So we're going to get to that. But this is you get the element here that's now being infused, and that is expectation.
Expectation.
Mm-hmm. So expectations occupied a substantial component for this concept of our mindset, as Stolberg was laying it out. In particular, as the key aspect for how we perceive the world around us. So in short, the principle, and we're going to come back to this a couple different times here, but the principle is that our consciousness, as Stolberg writes, is not perceiving the world as it is, but rather perceiving the world or reality filtered and modulated by our expectations. Stolberg's words. So his claim, and this he's not making this claim himself, he's bringing this from other sources, but the claim here is that we don't see things devoid of expectation. We don't interact with the world around us, but through our expectations in some sense. Mm. And that's weighty when you think about it, because as we've talked so much on the show, expectations matter a lot about how we experience things. And when there is a mismatch, which again is something Stolberg re-underscores here in this work, the mismatch theory concept is that the greater the mismatch between our expectations and reality, the greater the sense of suffering. Stolberg comes back to that again, particularly with some studies around the principle of how suffering is the result of a combination of things like that mismatch. So the greater the gap, the more I suffer, even if the thing is not so bad in some objective sense. So my expectations change my experience.
I think one of the best pieces of advice I got was to expect your race to hurt.
Yeah.
Because I can't say that I always did. I think that I had some really Disney fairy tale type expectations with running early on. And so it was hard to deal with. But then when I was able to learn this lesson that it's like expect it to hurt. It's going to hurt. Even if it's a great day, you're gonna hurt if you're getting the most out of yourself. And so I really clung to that. I think it's a really important thing to consider when you think of all things. Like if you expect something to be hard, but you know that you can do hard things, you're going to have a more successful day, most likely, than if you don't think about that beforehand and then you're surprised by the suffering.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. That tragic optimism concept is essentially the idea of having appropriate expectations. And so in Stolberg specifically uses the subheading for the section is expect it to be hard. We should. And it's not because we're not trying to have this like, you know, expect it to be bad, because then when it's not so bad, then it'll be better.
Called sandbagging yourself, saying, yes, I can only do that. Like I'm not going to, you know, win the race. I'm not going to run a PR. I'm going to just jog it. But you're not actually just jogging it, you know?
You're trying to trick yourself into having a better than expected experience. And that's not the thing. That's not what we're trying to get at here. And that's not really an effective coping mechanism with the difficulty, as it were, but rather appropriate expectations, what we can know, and what we can know in one sense, as we've already shared, is that things are hard. Life is filled with difficult things. As runners, as anyone who's tried to set a goal about anything, there's a lot of them, but we've shared one of the protocols that we've encountered over the years. They call it the WHOOP protocol. Comes from the WHOOP My Life organization. And one of the steps in their process is the obstacle step, where they specifically ask participants. So this is a goal setting protocol. They often use examples from things like people have health and fitness goals, actually. Wow, this fits better than I thought it did.
Or like diet
and nutrition. This is not from the book at all. But they have goals around things like that. Okay. They said positive thinking, right, actually produces worse results. Just positive thinking. The power of positive thinking is that it's going to make it worse for you.
But wait, Zach.
Hang on. Let me finish.
Okay.
Why is that? Because expectations that are rose-tinted, so positive thinking says, I'm going to be able to do this. But that thinking without the tragic optimism that says, yes, but it's going to be hard. If I forget that, yes, it's hard part, then when it is hard, I'm more likely to fail, which is why the WHOOP My Life organization specifically says positive thinking by itself is actually worse than not positive thinking. But positive thinking with appropriate expectation, which is the idea of anticipate, they call it the obstacle, anticipate the obstacle. And they don't mean the external obstacle, because you can't change that. They mean the internal obstacle, things about me that make it harder to achieve my goal. I anticipate them, then I can plan how I'm going to address those things, either in anticipation or when they occur, what am I going to do in response? We have a comment from Stolberg's book on that coming up as well. The point is, when we do that, we are much, much more likely to achieve our desired outcome.
So, Zach, I'd love for you to respond to this. I grew up in the 90s and early 2000s in school, where I had posters on the wall that had like little cats and other animals, and it said like, believe in yourself, and it was usually with a cute picture or a picture of Michael Jordan. So what would you say about, like, if you don't believe that you can do something, if you don't have confidence, you're never going to do it? So don't you have to have some of that tension, like believing in yourself but also being able to anticipate the hard and the difficult?
So if I believe
you can fly,
that I can set a world record in the marathon, you're telling me I can do it?
I am saying that if you had the capacity to, and it was paired with belief, that it would be more likely to happen than if you had the capacity but didn't have the belief.
You're saying appropriate expectations then?
Yes. So, but it's still like beyond a lot of these times that people do really special things, although they are training for being able to reach their greatest capacity, they don't always know that they're going to land where they do. Like, that's why you see them elated with excitement at the end of their achievement, usually. And they're crying, they can't believe that they could do that. Except that's the opposite of what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, that's not exactly.
But like the whole idea of believing in yourself. I'm just bringing up the idea that there is, at least for me, my best scenarios in training and running is when I hold these things in tension, where I believe in my ability to respond appropriately to situations. I believe that I open the door to what's possible. And I'm not going to be afraid if I receive feedback from a digital clock along the route that says I'm running pretty fast. I'm not going to be afraid of that. But I'm also not going to be afraid if I see that it's slower than I anticipate. I don't want that to impact me. So I imagine these scenarios and I imagine how I'll be successful regardless of those markers.
Yeah. So I don't know that I need to say anything else. So this whole like believe in yourself thing has an absurd end to it, an absurd side to it, which is this idea of like, I have not prepared very well for this race, but I believe that I can run a personal best, even though I haven't really hardly done anything to prepare for it. Well, that's stupid. Don't do that. But instead, there's a sense of belief. Well, okay, so you said it, and I'm just going to reiterate it in other senses to really draw out the thing that you said, because I think that's the profound thing, which is, what are you believing in? Are you believing in some specific uncontrollable outcome, like the time on the clock? I mean, you can't control the time on the clock. In some sense, you can by running fast enough, but you can control absolutely how you go about doing a thing, which may produce a certain time on the clock, and it may not. The point there is, what are you believing in? In believing in yourself, are you believing in your ability to run that specific pace for that amount of time? Because that's silly. Don't put that expectation on yourself, because hardship happens, and there's a very good chance, because we know this from running, that it won't end up exactly the way I had hoped it would.
But on the contrast, I do think it is good to, if your training is saying like you can do something, to be open to that possibility. Like, it's not silly to say it's possible for me to run X, Y, or Z on a day, but it's also more likely that I run this. And then if it's a hard day, I can at least do this. Like, it's the A, B, and C goal mentality.
So the thing you said that I really want to draw out, though, is you said believing in myself in the sense of like, I am strong.
I am strong. Yes.
Or I can suffer. Like, I can
do hard things.
I can do hard things. So like, that's different. That's not the same thing. And that is a controllable reality, because that now, this idea of I am strong, I can be strong whether I'm running my fastest race ever or I'm really having a bad day and it's not going super well. We gave the example last week about that, the perception of when you're in a run and you say, okay, this is hard, but I can continue. I can do this, even though it's hard, versus the person who says, this is hard and I can't do this. They're gonna respond very differently to that situation, right? So how I'm believing in myself, or what specifically myself I'm believing in, that has a lot to do with it. And so this is where we say, okay, expectation. We should be aware of how we are leveraging expectations on our reality. And if there's one aspect of this that is the most important in terms of how we're trying to really address the topic for ourselves as runners, it's this idea that we want to try to orient our thinking around the things we can influence and not place expectations on things we can't influence. So this gets into trying to combine all of these principles now into one basic takeaway, the inescapability trigger and the tragic optimism. Like, life is going to be hard. Things and people around me don't do what I want them to do all the time, right? Doesn't happen the way I want it to happen all the time. So I should not expect that other people are going to be what I want them to be for me, because they're likely to disappoint me at some time, whether or not they are in fact trying to be what I want them to be for me. They're still likely to disappoint me at some time. So there's a misplaced expectation. So there's that mismatch. I have to think about how I am filtering this reality with my expectations. And at the same time, I also then need to address, am I appropriately considering the things that I can control, the actionable things, and do I have those expectations then for those things? You know, it's the idea of, do I believe that I can be consistent, or that I can be strong, or that I am disciplined? And so applying some principled approach as opposed to a more circumstantial approach. We'll get into that next week. So I'm trying to not say too much right now, because that's more, in fact, the focus of next week. But for our purposes here, and for the mindset aspect of all of this, how we think about change and how we think about the thing we're trying to achieve matters immensely. So we have to be aware of the challenge and the difficulty. We have to try to identify specific challenges and difficulties even within these things, and then try to place appropriate expectations that follow.
And all this, trying to find the reason why, the joy, at least for me, finding joy in the run, I think helps us figure out what the expectations are serving us and what expectations are not serving us. And sometimes those expectations come externally, at least they do when you're a young runner. You feel like your coaches or certain people have expectations of you, and that can make it difficult to have the inner dialogue about what things you can control and what things you can't control. So I think those are all good things to process in order to set yourself free of them so that you can run to the best of your ability.
I wasn't going to go into it, but since you said that, I think I have to at least mention Bob Rosenthal's study with his mice, because you said the coach expectations on the athlete. And yes, in fact, there's studies that show a direct connection between performance and expectations that other people have on us. And so what Bob Rosenthal did, sneaky little bugger, is he went into his lab once in the middle of the night, and they've got a bunch of mice that they were doing testing with, and he put signs, labels, on all of their cages. And the labels either said that the mice were smart or that they were not smart. And he just randomly assigned them. It had nothing to do with anything they'd done so far. And then as they began the testing, and he was the only one in the lab who knew that it was just random, he just did it for kicks. They did the testing. They did all sorts of things that they do with mice to test their intelligence. Mazes. Can they find the food at the end? Can they, how long does it take them to learn how to hit the lever to make more food come out? Like that kind of thing, right? Well, guess what happened as a result? The mice who had the labels that they were smart outperformed the mice who had the dumb labels across the board. And yet, there was no difference between the mice. How is that possible? Well, Rosenthal actually apparently had a really hard time publishing this research. Initially, people were like, nah, I don't believe it. So then he started, okay, we need to find ways to prove it further. And they started looking in other domains. They looked in students taking tests and specifically measuring intelligence. They looked at strength, maximum muscle contraction strength, and they found that across the board in situations where people externally have higher expectations on those who are performing, they perform better.
So like the person proctoring the test and the person telling the athletes do the lifts.
Yeah, the whole thing. So if your coach has higher expectations, like you can do this thing and I expect you to do this thing, you are likely to perform better as a result of that.
There are outliers.
There are. There's always going to be outliers. But the principal point here is it sounds like magic. Like I can make you better simply by believing in you. But it's true. And we can't. Okay, so this is the part, like, we don't actually know exactly why this is true. The podcast that I first heard about this study on was an NPR podcast, and the host asked the question, "Well, how far can we take this? Like, if we expect that you can fly, can you?" And of course, it's like, "Well, no, because you can't. It's not a thing you can do." But if the expectation takes me from a current point or position and moves me slightly beyond that, that is the sweet spot. So that's where we say, when we talk about this idea of believing in ourselves, of our expectations we place on ourselves, you want to achieve something right now. We are quite confident that everyone listening to this right now wants to achieve something.
It might be with running. It might not be with running. It might be a different avenue in life. Yeah.
Might be. Chances are statistically that it has something to do with health and fitness. But the point is, we all want to achieve something. So where that expectation is most fruitful is when it is one layer beyond where I currently am. Do not expect miracles. If you are saying to yourself, I want to get faster this year, I want to increase my fitness. And last year I ran a marathon, and this time, this year, I want to cut an hour off of it. I don't know where your starting point was. Some of you listening would be running world records if you cut an hour off your marathon. But the point is that is extreme. Start with a minute, or maybe 5 or 10 or something. But the point is, you have the next level. If you're going to say, I believe in myself, your belief in yourself extends within the realm of what is stretching you a bit.
But also the things you control. So maybe it's not a time goal, which you've heard us say in this podcast.
No, and I was using that as an example only to illustrate the point.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that at all. And our final comment is there's always going to be a place for, if it's true that we think about the world around us always through some kind of filtered expectations, we think there's a place for trying to remove all expectations and instead just experiencing the thing as it is. And I don't know that I can advise you well broadly on that, but insofar as we're talking about running, we have worked very hard to try to understand what does this look like for runners. That's why we spent all of that time talking about how to train by effort in our recent series before the new year. But the principal point here is there's a way to experience a run that is devoid of expectation, or at least mostly devoid of expectation. And we think that that is a great place to be. Not that that's the way we should do everything all the time. In Brad Stolberg's words, it's apparently highly inefficient cognitively to have no expectation, because then every time something happens, you're having to like consider and generate a new response to the situation. But the point is, it's good to be able to experience the thing and not place any expectations on it. So how we can do that as a piece of this developing our mindset in the midst of change.
We look forward to continuing this conversation in the next few weeks. And if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, we invite you to do so. We show up every week for you. And now let's get on to the world of running. First up in the world of running is a little bit of news and chatter about Donovan Brazier.
And Who's that?
Well, he's the world record holder in the indoor 1600 meter run.
600.
He's also the American record holder in both the indoor and outdoor 800 meter run. And he is a world champion in the 800 at Doha. In 2019, he was the world champion in the 800.
Oh, I mean, that was 4 years ago.
Five
soon.
Well, he's been going through a lot. And so some people have counted him out. And so I wanted to bring his name back to the forefront, because you know how I said I really like the stories of the, like the comebacks and things. I am a fan of Donovan Brazier, number one. Number two, I think that now that he's letting himself actually heal and he's taking a step back from his training group, that he has a better shot. So the big news that brought his name to the forefront was that he left Nike Union Athletics Club, coached by Pete Julian, and now he's focusing on rebuilding, and he's actually feeling good, which is like the first that has happened in many years. So I'm hopeful, because a healthy Donovan Brazier is a dangerous Donovan Brazier, and I think, you know, if he's able to train well until the Olympic trials in June, it could be a good thing for him.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, I'm looking forward to his health and his rebuild and hopefully future success.
We will see. Hopefully. Yeah. My tragic optimism is coming to the fore. Or is that tragic pessimism?
Yeah.
All right. Well, number two here on the list this week is Dubai Marathon included some really interesting results.
Dubai double debuts.
Double debut victories.
Victories. Yeah, and maybe some, I'll add another D, disbelief.
Well, we'll see. So as reported by World Athletics, the Dubai Marathon is notoriously fast. As long as the weather
is it notorious is good. if it's good. I think it's famously fast.
Sure. Yeah, that works.
It's famously fast.
That being the case, it isn't always very competitive. And so it kind of just depends. That's why I say maybe that's why I say notoriously. But this year, it was fascinating. The unlikely victors in both the men's and the women's races. We're going to start with the women's because as a debutante in the marathon and coming very recently off of the track in middle distances.
Middle distance.
Tigist Katema of Ethiopia had never raced longer than 10,000 meters.
Right.
Until she ran this marathon.
Wild.
And had really not raced hardly at all above 1,500 meters. And that was really where she was most comfortable. Her 1,500 meter best, only from a few years ago, is 4 minutes flat. I mean, she's like world class. And yet, here she decides to run a marathon and wins Dubai.
Sure, there's some good money. We should have looked at the prize money.
There's really good money there. And did so in the fastest debut marathon time by a woman ever. Number 8 all time.
Wild. In fact, she's third on her country, Ethiopia's all-time list, but she would have, previous to this year, would have had the world or the national record for Ethiopia. Wild.
What time did she run? Thank you for asking. She ran 2:16:07.
It's fast.
This is Zach's skeptical face. That's kind of crazy.
That's kind of crazy.
That has the flavor of too good to be true a bit. What miler goes out and runs number 8 all time in the marathon in her first marathon without really ever showing? Well, no, actually, her first was not quite like that.
But she did win.
Her second was, but that's Sifan Hassan. We already knew she was going to be doing that because she's already something that no one else has ever been.
Right.
Tigist Katema is a moderately good middle distance runner.
Yeah.
But you never know. We always have to hand it to someone. You never know what you're capable of in an event until you try it. And there have been plenty of great track stars who could have been amazing marathoners and just didn't try it. And there were plenty of amazing marathoners who could have been better on the track and just never pursued it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we get that. And we're not going to discredit that. But here's Katema, 25 years old, debut in the marathon, and wins it.
Yes. And she, just to give you an idea of how this race unfolded, she ran with the other leaders. And at 5K, she made a decisive move. And she negative split her race, which is impressive as well.
Yep.
Let's contrast that with the men's race, though, because it was a little bit different in how it unfolded. It was, however, similarly won by a debutante.
Debutante? Adisu Gobena of Ethiopia, countryman of Katema, at 19 years of age.
Just a youth.
In his first marathon, won Dubai.
Yeah.
See Zach's skeptical face. Like, really? This happened? 19 years old. He just ran 2:05:01.
Yes. And he led. He led early on. And it was faster. It was under 2:02 for his first half marathon. And then things slowed up because they went out super hot. But this is the interesting thing about his story. He was throwing jav not long ago and then found that he had a knack for distance running. And the only known performance was a third place finish at the Delhi Half Marathon just 3 months ago. Crazy. But it is in his blood because his aunt was the runner up in the women's race this race.
Oh, family
for
time.
For Dubai, yeah.
Some family bonding.
And that was Ruby Aga.
Hopefully buying lunch or dinner or whatever time this race was run.
Well, I'm sure she won
a
great prize too.
My point is
the family, the whole family should party.
He's buying dinner because he's the one who won his race respectively. Now correct me if I'm wrong, but his aunt is also the defending champ.
It was one of the top 3, so
top
probably
three, okay.
I don't know. I think both of them were leaders for last year too, the 1 and 2. So I don't know which came in what order, but gotcha. Yeah.
Well,
impressive.
Dubai Marathon. We don't even know what to say anymore about marathons, because I feel like there's one of two things happening right now. Either it is too good to be true, and maybe one day we'll find out, or just the marathon is no longer the same thing that it was 6 years ago. It's just not. And is it the shoes? Is it, do people just decide that they're just going to put themselves into a state of suffering that is so far beyond what we thought was possible? We don't know, but it's something else.
Something to talk about on the podcast for sure.
It's giving us plenty to talk about, and we'll keep talking about it because you need to know about it, and then you can decide what you think about it too.
Now, this is a very different piece of running news, and it's just some insight about cold weather running.
Yeah, in particular, insight that comes from Strava data. So we all know,
How much Zach loves Strava.
We all know how much Zach does not love Strava.
But that has nothing to do with this, because we do like the data that it yields.
Yes, these data are always fascinating because Strava makes it possible for anyone to see certain levels of their data. And so in this particular instance, I don't know exactly what they were looking at to find this information, except that they were finding, okay, so how do people and what do people do when they're training in the winter? And what does that look like? And there are a couple broad notable trends, which are not surprising to anyone. First is treadmill. People use the treadmill a lot. Go figure. And second is it's common for runners to scale back their training load a bit during the winter. Broadly speaking, that tends to happen. As a matter of fact, they found that in particular, people scale back in the months of December, February, and November, not January. You know why, don't you, Andy?
Because of New Year's resolutions.
Suddenly, everyone gets a whole lot more consistent in January, lasts about a month. And according to Strava data, that's as long as it lasts. We're not surprised. So we always talk about this. Every year we all talk about this.
I have to say February might be the hardest month in the whole year for
me. In the Midwest.
Anyway. Yeah. Not for consistency. I get the stuff done. It's just the hardest month to train when it's snowing and it's been snowing. This winter though is a little different. I'm not going to have the snow fatigue.
Yeah, because you're going to be out of the Midwest the whole entire time.
That's right. I'm going to be gone during February.
So that said, I disagree though. I think December is the hardest month to train in because
parties,
holidays, life schedule and routine is so much different in the month of December for anyone who celebrates a holiday in the month of December, because you know, there's just that plus school breaks plus, you know, the whole like society changes in terms of how we operate. Okay, well, that being the case, in the Strava data, there's more to be said. And then author here from the article with Outside Magazine had a few tips as a result of these things. First, yes, focus on the hard months. Put some time and effort into November, December, and February, making sure that we keep it consistent, making sure that we find a way to get it done. And what are some of those things that are going to help? Well, the rest of these tips, in fact. So the next one is every bit counts. And this is important because apparently, I'm going to quote the author here, the median distance for goal completers' individual runs was 24% higher than those who didn't make it. So yearly goals aren't achieved by like monumental moments. It's just through the day-to-day stuff. And so they're saying like, okay, your yearly goals are going to happen if you do the little bits at a time. And the data prove that. And so what then helps us get those every bits? Find a friend is one of the big ones. And so they actually see in the data, not for everybody, of course, because some of us would rather not find a friend. But
I think it helps me immensely.
Yes, well,
enjoy it immensely.
You and almost everybody else, apparently, because athletes who ran with other people in 2022, yes, the data are a year removed because it takes longer to crunch We don't have 2023's data at this level. But in 2022, they had a 17% higher goal completion rate.
Okay.
Yes. But we don't know exactly how often they were running with other people.
And how are they defining goals? Like those little silly goals that Strava wants you to
join? Is another problem that I have. So Strava has a built-in mechanism for this concept of like goal completion. No one's paying any attention. Like,
I'm just doing it for the free guacamole.
What?
Sometimes you get perks for completing goals. That's one of them is free guacamole. Yep.
All right. So then the last one, people who met their goal had 15% more active days than those who missed their goals. So, of course, we know that is likely to be the case. If we can stay consistent, we achieve the thing we set out to do.
And stay healthier.
In all around. Now, they were talking specifically about the winter times. And so one of the things here that's notable is that how we operate during the winter has a lot to say about how successful we will be in the other times during the year. Never forget that running as a sport and the training that we do for it is not an instant gratification kind of thing. And so 6 months of training sets you up great for a race, but 6 months of training and then 6 more months of training sets you up even better for a race. And so we look for how can we be that kind of person. And hopefully some of the stuff that we've been sharing here today, in fact, may be helpful in that regard. So we took some extra time to set up our series. And we're going to then continue for the next 2 weeks on chunks of the topic from Stolberg's work and be able to share with you what that looks like as we're trying to achieve our goals and make positive change ourselves in our own lives for the sake of our sport or otherwise. So stay tuned for that and make sure you are asking your questions along the way because we want to answer them. And especially if you've got questions about things like your goals or changes that you're trying to make or some of the things you're trying to accomplish in your training right now, it may in fact feed right into the topic we're addressing further still. Ask your questions at a2zrunning.com/questions or send an email directly to us via questions@a2zrunning.com.
Thank you all so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.